It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in just a bit, we'll explore the secret world of sleep and how science may be able to harness the power of sleep to improve learning, health, and more.
But first, the big news all week long has been Syria and whether or not the United States should pursue military intervention there.
Months ago, President Obama said his red line for intervention in Syria would be the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons against the Syrian people. So now that the red line has been crossed, is a strike against Syria justified? Well, not so fast, according to our next guest.
We're joined now by Dov Zakheim, former Undersecretary of Defense. He was Chief Financial Officer for the U.S. Department of Defense. He wrote a piece for the nationalinterest.org titled, Don't Attack Syria. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Dov, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Why shouldn't the U.S. stage a military intervention in Syria?
Well, a lot of different reasons. The first one is it might not have much of an impact. If we're talking about a missile strike, for example, President Clinton tried that in 1998 against Afghanistan and Sudan. Nothing much happened, except we wound up fighting another war in Afghanistan a few years later. If we're talking about a more serious airstrike, in the first place, Syrian air defenses are pretty sophisticated, frankly a lot more sophisticated than, say, the Libyan air defenses that we faced 2 years ago. And the Russians, who are clearly supporting Mr. Assad, could well be manning some of those air defenses. And then what happens if we have some casualties? So it's not at all clear to me that we would actually succeed in what we wanted to accomplish. But then there are some other factors. The Jordanians have already said they don't want us operating from their soil. The Arab League has said it really doesn't want to see an attack. It'll just create more anti-Americanism in a region that really hates us right now. The British have backed out. Other than the French, the Europeans aren't involved and don't want to be. We're isolated in this. So what happens if we were to attack Syria? All we're going to do is encourage the Iranians, who are backing Assad, encourage Hezbollah, who are backing Assad, maybe unleash them against American targets. Maybe we get sucked into a much bigger thing, because we never know how these things end. And then where do we go? They're all downsides. In fact, if we were to succeed in having a hand in bringing down Mr. Assad, then we will have changed yet another Arab regime. And if you're sitting in Tehran, Iran, and you're watching all of this, you'll say, well, I guess the only way I can survive is by doing what the North Koreans do. And that is to say, they will go hell for leather to get nuclear weapons, exactly what we don't want them to do.
The administration is making the case, and Secretary of State Kerry did today, that Syria has used chemical weapons. If there isn't some kind of military response, the message to other countries is chemical weapons are on the table now. You can use them. Is that message important?
The message is important. There's only one problem with this. This is not the first time chemical weapons have been used. This is a situation where chemical weapons are being used in a civil war. We did absolutely nothing when Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against the Kurds in the early 1990s. In fact, we supported, and I underline that, we supported Saddam Hussein in his war with Iran in the 1980s when he used chemical weapons. So what are we talking about here?
If not military intervention, do you think the United States should play some other kind of role? If so, what?
Absolutely. I mean, everybody wants to see a diplomatic solution, including, by the way, the Russians and the Chinese, who are totally supportive of Mr. Assad. We've got to work this out diplomatically, and the Secretary of State should be working full-time to do that. We're not going to get anything solved with some kind of military attack, except, once again, getting us involved in a Middle East war. And to argue that this is in America's national interest, compared to what? It just seems to me that getting involved in civil wars has not worked out terribly well for us. We're not good at resolving them. We're not good at building countries up after they've been sort of quieted down. Why are we doing this? Why are we risking our kids' lives for this? That's my question.
Do you think that the Obama administration painted itself into a corner with the talk of chemical weapons as a red line?
Oh, well, it certainly did. But on the other hand, I'm sure they have enough good spin doctors to paint themselves out of it. And quite frankly, since nobody wants them to attack, nobody wants us to attack, if the administration were to come up with some formulation that allowed the president to wiggle out of the corner he got himself into, I don't think anybody would complain.
Would you feel better about military intervention had, say, the vote in the UK Parliament had gone differently and they had backed this intervention and more allies apart from France were on board?
Well, I think for a start, let's look at what happened with Libya. The Russians were upset at the way things worked out, but nevertheless, there was some kind of action in the UN. We had the Arab League with us. We had a lot of Europeans with us. We even had neutral Sweden with us. The list of what's usually called the coalition of the willing in this case is one country. That's just not good enough.
Do you think Americans are more skeptical about this kind of military intervention after our long campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Absolutely. And they're skeptical for several reasons. The first is simply, you know, what have we come up with in these places? There's practically another civil war in Iraq again. And look at the lives that were lost. Look at the billions that were spent. Look at the efforts that we put in for a decade and what's come out of it. In Afghanistan, we still don't know what the answer is. And perhaps had we focused only on Afghanistan in the early years of that war, we might not even be fighting today. But that's what's done is done, as they say. But Americans are tired of that. The president himself talked about nation building beginning at home. So if we get involved in Syria and we get more deeply involved in Syria, are we going to start nation building in Syria as well? How does that square with what he said? Americans are tired, and rightly so. Nobody opposes. I don't think anybody in this country really opposes getting involved militarily where our national interests are truly threatened. But that's not the case here.
Is there a case to be made for humanitarian intervention, even before the chemical weapon attacks, reports of a lot of conventional weapons being used to kill civilians in Syria by the regime? Is there ever a case where, if it's not in our national interest, there's still enough of a humanitarian issue that we can intervene?
There might be, and the question, of course, is how you intervene. I personally supported the idea of arming the rebels 18 months ago, as recently as 6 months ago. But you know what? Who are the rebels today? The best organized rebel group is a group called al-Nusra. They're tied in with the al-Qaeda extremists. The best organized group is the one that comes out on top, so that if Assad falls, these guys are going to be in charge. That's not a very good thing. So, yes, there may have been a case for humanitarian intervention, and then, of course, we should ask, why did the president focus on 1,400 people being gassed, which is a terrible thing, but not on 100,000 people being killed, which is what's gone on for 2 years? There's a huge amount of inconsistency here, and I suspect that's why members of the British Parliament, that's why members of Congress, both Democratic and Republican, are so skeptical about what's going on.
The momentum from what we're hearing from the White House seems to suggest that they're going to do something. They're going to do some kind of military strike. Do you think that it's for sure going to happen, or is there still a chance that they might turn back from that?
Well, you know, I don't know what the White House will determine. I certainly hope that they will think a second time about this. We really don't want to be internationally isolated. How long the French would stand alongside us, who knows? But just to be on our own with one other country that, by the way, has not always consistently supported us either, they didn't support us on Iraq, I think is a very, very dangerous thing for the United States. And we, you know, the world is worried that we're going isolationist. Well, guess what? If we're on our own, the world will isolate us. It's not a very good place to be.
Dov, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dov Zakheim, former Undersecretary of Defense, also Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Department of Defense. We've got a link to his piece, Don't Attack Syria, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, it's a look at what's happening inside our brains while we sleep. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
When a guy says that to you on the worst day of your life, you say, absolutely.
Don't worry, these are the worst years of your life.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic, proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor.
Wisconsin Public Radio is everywhere. On the radio, online, on demand, on your smartphone, on the way to work, on your mind. Go to WPR.org and turn it on.
Coming up at 11 o'clock on Monday, Judith Sears Poisson's in for Larry Mueller to talk about fall bird watching. For many birds, the fall migration has already begun, and Judith Sears Poisson finds out what to watch for and what guidelines to follow for fall and winter birding. That's coming up at 11 o'clock as Judith fills in for Larry Mueller.
Now here's a look at headlines with WPR's Noah Ovshinsky. Thanks, Noah. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
Coming up, we'll round up the latest news in Wisconsin with our assistant news director.
First, though, a look at the secret world of sleep. We all sleep, hopefully, and we're in bad shape if we try to go without it. But why? And what exactly does sleep do for us?
Penelope Lewis wants to answer those questions and a lot more. She's a neuroscientist at the University of Manchester, where she runs the Sleep and Memory Lab. Her new book is The Secret World of Sleep. Penelope, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Well, for such a common event like sleeping, it seems like there's still a lot of mystery about why we do it and what it is. How far along is the science on this?
I think it's really one of the age-old questions. Why do we spend so much time sleeping? As humans, we actually spend a third of our lives asleep. And if you think about that, that's more time than we spend doing anything else. So it suggests that sleep must be really important for something. And psychologists and neuroscientists have been trying to work out what that is for quite a long time now. You're asking me how far along are we, and I'd say we have a lot of new ideas about this. There's a lot of exciting research going on at the moment, but we certainly don't know all the answers.
Well, one thing we do seem to have a pretty good handle on is that when we don't sleep, bad things happen, lots of bad things. Can you tell us some of the stories about what happens when we try to go without sleep?
Well, I'm sure anecdotally everybody knows that they generally feel pretty terrible if they don't get enough sleep. We tend to be in a worse mood. Obviously, we also tend to feel a bit cold. But some of the stories that you're thinking of are actually errors in judgment. So it seems like the thing that we really struggle the most with when we're sleep-deprived is making difficult judgments where we need to pull together lots of different pieces of information and kind of synthesize them and make a tricky decision or a judgment. So examples of some disasters that have happened when people fail in these kind of judgments or make wrong judgments because they're sleep deprived are things like the Exxon Valdez disaster, where the person driving that boat actually was sleep deprived, and also several nuclear disasters such as Chernobyl, for instance. The Space Shuttle Challenger disaster is another one that's been partially blamed on poor decisions due to sleep deprivation.
You, in your book, look at some other things with sleep deprivation. I think, did I see some senses are less perceptive? I remember something about the sense of smell, not being able to pick out different smells as much when we're sleep deprived.
Yeah, that's right. There are some really kind of quirky, strange things like that. So there is evidence that our sense of smell is less acute, and if you give people, say, three or four different smells and ask them, which one of these is lavender, for instance, which one of these is lemon, people will have more trouble with that kind of thing when they're sleep-deprived.
And there's some research out, I think I've seen, that when we are sleep-deprived, we eat more, don't we?
There is some evidence that people are more hungry when they're sleep-deprived. That's right. So there's a link between sleep and appetite.
Well, let's start digging into some of the good stuff that sleep does. I love that you use the phrase, I think it's spring cleaning for the mind. How does sleep sweep up our minds a little bit?
So this is a really interesting idea. It's been shown that across the day, while we're doing lots of different activities and learning lots of things, synapses in our brain, so those are the connections between neurons which represent memories, get strengthened, and they continually get strengthened across the day, and they can get strengthened so much that there's not really space to strengthen them anymore. And that's a problem because the strengthening is learning. And you don't want to reach the point where you're at capacity and you can't learn anymore. What happens across sleep, and this is particularly the deep stage of sleep that we call slow wave sleep, is that those synapses get systematically weakened again. And it seems that this is done in such a way that the relative strength is maintained. So the things that were the strongest remain the strongest, and the things that were the weakest remain the weakest, but everything just gets downscaled. And by doing that, the weak things may eventually go below a critical threshold so that that information is actually lost. So it's a way of getting rid of some of the weak, probably garbage, that got strengthened up during the day that you don't actually want to hold on to.
So it's like, if I can use a computer metaphor, my hard drive is full by the end of the day. Overnight, I'm getting rid of those, dancing cat pictures and keeping, the critical files for tomorrow's show or something like that.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good analogy.
Well, what do we know about in terms of the sleep, the brain on sleep and memory and just a little bit more about whether or not we can, get over things better and remember things, more the benefits of what's going on inside
the benefits of sleep.
Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of thing that I really like to talk about. So now you're asking questions that I can answer. So I think one of the most interesting and exciting areas of the study of sleep at the moment is the study of what sleep does for our memories. And that's actually what my research is on. Over the last 10 or 15 years, research in this area has really exploded, and it's been shown definitively that many kinds of memory are actually actively strengthened across sleep. So that means if you're learning something like playing the piano or learning to ride a bike, those kind of skills, you might practice it to a certain point across the day, and it might stop improving if you practice too much. But then if you have a night of sleep where you're obviously not practicing at all, and then try again the next day, you'll be better. And it's been shown that you can improve by as much as 20% on these kind of skills just by sleeping for a night. So that's one kind of memory, but many other kinds of memory also seem to benefit from sleep. Sometimes some of them aren't necessarily strengthened. Some of them just are protected a bit. So if you think about memories for things like, a list of words that you might have learned if you're studying your Spanish vocabulary, or a set of pictures that you've seen, those kind of memories tend to decay gradually across time, so we forget stuff. And what sleep does is it seems to protect them against decay, so they won't decay as much across a period of sleep as they would across wakefulness.
I want to follow up on what you said about learning to ride a bike and how you could learn 20% faster if you do get a good night of sleep. Don't we do that anyway? We try a new task, we go to bed, and then presumably our brain does what it should and we learn stuff. Is there something I'm missing about how we can use sleep more strategically when we're learning things?
How we can use it strategically,
yeah,
to emphasize that?
Mm-hmm.
So, absolutely, hopefully our brain processes this information automatically, and we don't have to do anything at all. All we have to do is get a good night of sleep. But it does look as though we can be a bit strategic about this, and we're starting to understand ways that we can manipulate this and get even more benefit for the memories that we want strengthened specifically by understanding how the process works. So shall I start by explaining to you how we think some of this strengthening actually works, and then I can explain how we can manipulate that?
Sure, yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah. So we think at the moment it works. Probably the number one theory is that memories are often actually replayed when you're asleep. So if you were learning to play the piano, then certain areas of your brain associated with moving your hands will have been highly active while you're doing that. And when you sleep subsequently, there's a lot of evidence showing that those same areas will spontaneously become active again. So exactly the areas that were involved in learning that skill that you were practicing. And we call this replay, spontaneous replay or reactivation during sleep. And it seems that that reactivation, it's like your brain is actually practicing the skill while you're asleep. And it leads to a strengthening of the right synapses to allow you to actually perform it better the next day when you come back to it.
Well, that's pretty nice. So you're even when you think you're resting, your brain is still working on it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of one of the kind of main mechanisms that we think is important for the strengthening of memories in sleep. And so now the next part of your question was about how we can actually manipulate that. So what can we do to capitalize on this knowledge to get our brains to strengthen up the memories that we're actually the most interested in? And it turns out that we can do this. And what we can do is we can trigger those reactivations and target the memories that we want. And that's been done in a few ways so far. It's been done by pairing the learning, so when you're practicing the piano, with either sounds, which would be easy in the case of learning piano, so the sounds of the piano, or else smells. So if you're smelling a particular smell, and what's been used typically is actually the scent of roses while you're practicing. And then when you're sleeping subsequently, representing those, either the sound or the smell, whatever was paired with the learning, obviously in a quiet way that doesn't wake you up, that's been shown to trigger a triggered replay. So you no longer have to wait around for your brain to actually replay the stuff you want. You can trigger the replays that you're targeting and that therefore strengthen those memories, which are the ones that you're interested in, instead of waiting for it to maybe replay those or maybe replay lots of memories of, you know, the fight you had with your boyfriend that you might not want to strengthen.
We're talking to sleep researcher Penelope Lewis about her new book, The Secret World of Sleep, and we're going to continue that after the news. You can join the conversation.
And we want to know whether you've got a question about how sleep works and what it does for us, maybe how it works with the emotional world as well. Have you had an experience with sleep deprivation and how did it affect you? And have you found a way to sleep strategically, like we were just beginning to talk about there? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
I think I might try learning something with some eucalyptus oil nearby and then dabbing it on a pillow. Okay, well, there's more to talk about. We'll delve into this more. Stick around. We'll take your calls after the news. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about sleep with Penelope Lewis, and we're wondering about your sleep questions, your experiences with sleep and dreams, and if you found that sleep makes you more creative. Do your dreams make you more creative? And what have you found about sleep deprivation? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org.
And we'll go right to Judy, who's with us in St. Paul, Minnesota. Judy, hi.
Hi.
What's your sleep story or question?
Well, I worked in a medical setting, the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift, and we would do this on occasional weekends for three nights in a row. And I found, at least it was my experience, what the author said, that it was a constant battle to stay awake, and we found ourselves eating maybe once an hour. Obviously, a lot more consumption of caffeine, and we were cold. We were wearing blankets from the warmers at the stations, and it threw off, at least for me, sleeping for the next maybe 2 weeks. It took me that long to get back on some sort of rhythm of sleeping through the night.
Judy, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. And Penelope, I mean, this is a common story for people in the medical profession, either weird hours or incredibly long hours with little sleep. As somebody who studies sleep, how much does that worry you?
Well, I think if it was me, I'd be worried, selfishly. But I think it is worrying. It's what I would say about shift work is it's, you know, it's known that it's very unhealthy. It's obviously unhealthy at the time, as your caller has described, but it can also have long-term health problems associated with it. So people who have worked shift work, you know, for a large portion of their lives can have all kinds of later health problems. And I think the comment I would make is it's very strange that employers have these on-off patterns of shift work. So she described having just 3 nights on and then presumably going back to a more standard routine after that and taking 2 weeks to readjust. It would be much healthier to have a week of nights and then, you know, 3 weeks off on a normal routine. So I suppose that it works that way because of people's social lives and needing to care for their families and see their friends and things, but it's definitely not healthy.
Now, one area of research that we've touched on a little bit, we haven't really dived into yet, is sleep and emotional health. It seems like the jury is still out about whether sleep sort of pounds in traumatic events or whether it helps us process them and get rid of them.
That's right. So this is really an area of controversy at the moment, and there is data showing both of those things that you've just described. There's one really exciting theory that suggests that emotional memories of emotional events, so maybe something traumatic that you experienced during the day, are actually processed during sleep, and that processing sort of detaches the emotion from the memory. So though the memory itself, the facts of what happened may be strengthened up, it's less upsetting when you remember it afterwards. But then there's counter evidence showing the exact opposite, that when you remember things after sleep, you actually get stronger activation in your emotional system, areas of the brain like the amygdala, which respond to strong emotions. And in some studies, it's shown that people actually rate things as more emotional after they've slept. So there's data both ways, and it's something that we really need to keep working on.
How are we, the research world, trying to suss that out? Which side of that is going to take priority?
Well, I think that we just need to do more experiments and try and work out why the data show such different things. So I think what's important to say is that the studies I'm talking about, which appear to conflict, although they are using pretty similar paradigms, there are some differences between them, and the difference in the result is probably down to that. So, for instance, in the studies where things that are emotional seem to lose their emotion and become more bland after sleep, people were not told to try and remember these things. They were just shown pictures, asked to rate them for how emotional they were, and then the next day they were shown those same pictures again and asked to rate them again. They were never told to remember them. Whereas in the studies which have tended to show the opposite, it's normally when people have been tested on their memory and told to remember the images. So it may be that it's something to do with remembering that causes this difference.
Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a sleep deprivation story to share, or did you learn how sleep helped your life? Did it make a difference getting better sleep? 800-642-1234 is the number.
Now, insomnia is something that attacks just about everybody at one time or another in their lives. Sometimes people have chronic insomnia. What do we know about, I don't know, how we can avoid insomnia and what to do when we do find ourselves in the midst of a bout of it?
Yeah, insomnia is a really common problem. I think in order to avoid it, what we can do is work on what we call our sleep hygiene, and that's actually nothing to do with cleanliness or bacteria. That's hygiene in the psychological sense. So that means making sure that our bed and our bedroom is strongly associated with sleep, that we're sleeping at the right times of day for when our body wants to sleep, so that would be nighttime for humans, hopefully not during shift work, that it's things like that it's dark enough, that it's quiet enough, that it's an appropriate temperature, that we're not drinking too much caffeine. All of those things are part of our sleep hygiene. So if we take care with all those things, it's going to help our sleeping a lot. But for people that really have problems with insomnia, it's not necessarily going to prevent it.
We'll take a call now. We've got Maureen in Milwaukee on the line. Hi there, Maureen.
Hi. My question is regarding the racing mind. When you have worry and that interferes with your sleep, You were just talking about insomnia. It's a form of insomnia, but I'm wondering, when the racing mind, is that just our, are we just interrupted? Is that emotion, or are we trying to figure out what's going to be next because we're worrying about something?
Gotcha, Maureen. Thank you so much for the call. Penelope, is there research on this? I think we've all been there at one point or another.
This is an interesting question. I have to say I don't know so much about the research on the racing mind, as Maureen phrases it. But what I do know is that it's a common enough problem that people have trouble getting to sleep, or else they find they wake up in the middle of the night really worried about something with this racing mind. And the only thing I could advise, and what many sleep experts would advise, is if you wake up and you can't get back to sleep because of that kind of problem, then it's a good idea to, rather than just lying there thinking about it, it's maybe a good idea to try and deal with it. Get up, write down your problems, maybe try and write down some solutions. Try and calm yourself down a bit and then go back to bed and try and sleep again. That's probably a common sense answer, though, that you would have guessed yourself.
I think it's advice that's probably helped a lot of people, though. I've heard people say that's how they solved it. I think we have time for one more caller. Kelly is with us in Appleton. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I'm calling to get your opinion on sleep deprivation and new parents. I have a two-year-old that did not sleep, and I swear to you she did not sleep for a year. And I can remember driving to the grocery store and or to work and getting to the parking lot and not really remembering how I got there, which is scary. And, I mean, my brother just had two twin boys, and they are at their wit's end. So I just wanted to get some pointers from you on how you can lessen the blow.
Kelly, just briefly, Kelly, thank you. We've all been there. Penelope, a quick response. When we have that sleep deprivation, we can't fight it. Anything we can do?
Caffeine.
Caffeine's all we got?
Well, caffeine's one pretty good thing to do. If you really can't fight it, so you don't have time or there's no way for you to get that sleep, then I think caffeine temporarily makes you feel a bit more alert. But really the only true solution is to get some sleep if you can.
All right. Well, Penelope, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
That was sleep researcher Penelope Lewis. Her new book is called The Secret World of Sleep.
You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. I'm curious if you have sleep advice that you could share with us. If you were a parent, maybe, like our last caller, Kelly, there, how did you get that sleep when you couldn't? Central Time Facebook page, give us your sleep advice.
Coming up, news guy Noah Ovshinsky brings us up to date on the latest news from Wisconsin.
Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Noah. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Coming up after the news yesterday that the federal government won't sue states over their marijuana laws, we'll take a long view of the social and cultural history of marijuana in the United States.
First, our assistant news director, Noah Ovshinsky, joins us for his weekly look at the top ongoing Wisconsin news stories.
Noah, thanks for joining us again.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Well, we started off the week hearing a lot of reaction to a big federal decision on casinos. What's going on?
Right. The proposed casino in Kenosha has been one of those issues that have sort of surfaced and then sort of gone in the background and then resurfaced. Late last week, the issue came back to the forefront because the Interior Department, the federal Interior Department, approved the Menominee's plan, the long-proposed idea, really, to open an off-reservation casino at the former Kenosha dog racing track.
So politicians are lining up to react or nuance this. First, let's start locally. How did local legislators
right.
feel?
Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca, a Democrat who's from Kenosha, says he wants Governor Walker to okay the plan. He and several officials, in fact, from that area want the governor to okay the plan because they see it as a potential job creator in a region that really is desperate for jobs.
So Governor Walker is really the decider at this point, or he's the next big
step. Mm-hmm.
What's he saying?
Well, Walker basically has said that he doesn't want any net growth of gaming in the state. And he also says that he'd like all of the tribes in Wisconsin to endorse the Kenosha Casino plan, which is difficult because not every tribe is on the same page as it relates to this proposed casino.
Especially right in that area, right? There's some an existing casino that worries they might be damaged by this.
Right. The requirement that Governor Walker has that the tribes agree is something of a I'll call it a poison pill, I guess, because it's unlikely that every tribe in the state is going to support the idea, and, you know, primarily the Potawatomi, because they have a casino in Milwaukee. And, of course, they don't want to lose business.
The gambling issue has been toxic for some state leaders in the past. What's the balancing act the governor is facing right now?
Right. I think he's trying to please two groups of people. One is conservatives who hate gambling. They don't like it on a moral basis. And then also some liberals, actually, who have an issue with gambling because they see it as an industry that really preys on low-income gamblers.
But in a way, he's put the decision back out to the tribes. If you agree, if you can make sure there's no net growth in gambling in the state, then he would sign off on it?
Yeah. And actually, Walker said that, in fact, he suggested this week that the Potawatomi, who own the casino in Milwaukee, and the Menominee, who want to build the casino in Kenosha, he suggested that the two should actually, you know, work together. Whether or not that happens is anybody's guess. The Menominee have said that, you know, they'd like to look into the idea. No clear answer yet from the Potawatomi, at least that I know of.
Okay. Well, that will come up a lot, I'm guessing, in the next couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right now, Congress is on recess, and the congressional delegation is back here in Wisconsin, and they're saying stuff. What have been a couple of the big issues?
They are. I sort of picked this as one of the issues for us to discuss because some of our Congress people have come out on some big issues that people in the state really care about, and they've come out in a very public way. The first one is voting rights. And if you'll recall, Rob, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down key provisions of the Voting Rights Act several weeks ago. And Congressman James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin really very publicly asked his Republican colleagues at the National Committee meeting that they should, in fact, as Congress people, actually bring back the Civil Rights, or rather the Voting Rights Act.
Is he saying bring it back as it was, or bring it back with some revisions for now, or has that been clear?
That's not exactly clear, but what he's saying is this is something that Congress needs to act on, that we need, as a country, needs the protection of the Voting Rights Act to make sure that people have the ability to act. And I don't know if you'll recall, actually, Sensenbrenner has sort of skin in the game because he was actually the chair of the House Judiciary Committee when the law was reauthorized a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I think in 2006 it was. And he worked very hard then to get this law reauthorized.
It'll be interesting to see what the response will be from his fellow Republicans. He's a fairly prominent, noted as a conservative Republican.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, also this week, Congressman Sean Duffy joined Sensenbrenner in his call to bring back the Voting Rights Act. Now, Duffy has said he supports Sensenbrenner's effort to do that. It's not exactly clear what Duffy means when he says that, you know, if he'd like the old, you know, Voting Rights Act to come back, or a modified version to reflect what he calls sort of the world that we live in 2013. So that's still a little unclear.
Well, and that's kind of, there's the rub, because that was part of the ruling saying that the Voting Rights Act as passed back in the 60s doesn't match the reality we face in 2013.
Right. And the reality on the ground is until Congress acts, the Justice Department won't be able to approve changes to voting laws as it has historically been able to do and required to do in areas, especially in the South. You know, already since the Supreme Court struck down aspects of the Civil Rights Act, or rather the Voting Rights Act, North Carolina and I believe Texas have tried to pass voter ID laws, which some people see as discriminatory. And 6 months ago, the Justice Department would have been able to probably prevent those from happening. Now the Justice Department just has to sue after the fact to prevent it from happening.
Well, another big issue, obviously, in the news is Syria, a possible military action by the U.S. against Syria. The senator, former Senator John Kerry, the Secretary of State, saying, yeah, we've got solid proof of the use of chemical weapons. What are we hearing from our delegation on that?
Yeah, this week, U.S. Representative Mark Pocan from the Madison area, a Democrat, saying that he'd like President Obama to get congressional approval before the U.S. launches a strike against Syria. You know, he thinks there needs to really be a full debate before the U.S. intervenes in another civil war, you know, especially given that there hasn't been it's not a direct attack on the United States. It's not like 9/11 where, you know, Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda, you know, attacked the United States, obviously, and they were backed by Afghanistan. In this case, nobody's necessarily attacking us. And so Congress as a whole, including Mark Pocan, says, no, let's wait a second. Let's take a breath. Let's debate this before we do that. Also, Republican U.S. Representative Tom Petri from Fond du Lac also says that congressional approval is necessary in order for the president to order an attack on Syria.
So this is one that's bringing, at least in this case, a Democrat and a Republican together. Is this an issue of their ideology happens to coincide, or is this an issue, do you think, of protecting Congress's role in war making?
Everything. I think it's a little bit of both. I do think that the experience in Afghanistan, the experience in Iraq, you know, I think Congress is, I think they want to take their time with this, you know, and the UN, of course, has not come back with the report as to whether or not chemical weapons has in fact been used. Parliament in Britain just voted, and Britain, in fact, is not supporting a potential strike on Syria. That struck a blow to the prime minister there in Britain. And so I think what you see, you know, both in Britain and here and elsewhere is just this sense that we need to slow down and we need to really think about this before we attack Syria. And it's a very complicated situation.
All right. And then back here in Madison, the ongoing saga, the protests at the state capitol, and a lot of news again this week on that.
Yeah. I mean, there have been something on the order of maybe 300 arrests in the last several weeks. But actually this week, you know, the generally peaceful protests took a slightly different and I'd say probably more violent turn this week.
So what happened?
On Monday, a gentleman named Damon Terrell was arrested after he allegedly injured a police officer who was trying to arrest him. Now, there's video of the encounter, and what it shows is one and then several police officers tackling Terrell.
So what was he charged with? What has happened since then?
Right. Well, he's only been sort of tentatively charged, one with a felony and another felony related to assaulting the officer and a misdemeanor related to resisting arrest. On those, he hasn't been formally charged with. Those are just tentative charges, from what I understand. And really what this is about is it's not exactly clear, you know, he wasn't actually cited for protesting. So it's not clear why the police targeted him for arrest.
And is this someone, do you know, who's been involved with the protests a lot or a new face at the Capitol?
Yeah, he's actually been at the Capitol a lot since the protests began and has been, you know, arrested several times. So he is a familiar face for police in the Capitol. You know, depending on who you talk to, you know, it was either an example of police being right, you know, being right in the way that they dealt with the situation or the police going too far.
How has the protest crowd, the protesters, reacted to what they've seen in this so far?
Not well, as you might expect. You know, at the very least, some will say, you know, it's an example of the police going too far. Others have suggested that it's a case of racial profiling. And so really what we've seen is a change in tone here with the protests this week.
And then Marty Beal from the State Employees Union was one of the 300 who's been arrested. He was just arrested this last week, right?
Right. So union officials are now getting involved. Firemen have come down and been involved in the protests. And so there's really no sign yet that the crowds that have been gathering for weeks now, large crowds, I should say, that have been gathering for weeks now, there's really no sign that they're going away, at least, you know, not yet.
All right. No end in sight there.
Nope.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Noah. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Rob.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. He joins us each week at this time.
Coming up, the social history of marijuana in the United States is a long history, a lot of involvement with the various cultural communities, and of course, maybe some big changes in the work now. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.